Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast.
Hello, everyone. I've got a new format for you for this episode of the podcast. One day I was sitting out in the market square of Shaanxi, China, where I've been staying, and having a cup of coffee with some people that I just met. And one of them suggested, hey, why don't you record this? We can do a podcast while we're drinking coffee. And I'm going to call it the Coffee Cast. I know it's really a creative name. There were five of us at the table besides me. There was Kathy from England, and we had Hugh and Pauline, who were bicycling across part of China, and they're also from England, and also Liam, who you just met in the last podcast. And I think things went pretty well during the show. We talked about whatever came to mind, so the subject jumped around a lot. As usual, there were things happening in the background. You are going to hear some nails being pounded and saws sawing, people walking around and talking. You're going to hear some horses and bells a-jingling. And there's a couple of scooters and even some carts being pulled across the cobblestone streets. I hope these noises add to the excitement of the podcast rather than simply annoying you. Let me know what you think about that. There were a couple of little chunks that I had to just take out because too much was happening all at once, and I've put in a little pause when that happens, just so you know that there's some time missing. Thanks for all of your support, and with that being said, let's jump right into the Coffee Cast.
One thing I regret about bike traveling is that you can't take a lot of things back with you. So I could fill my wardrobe with gorgeous Chinese clothes, to be honest, but I'm not going to carry them all the way.
Just buy a load of stuff and give it to Kathy to take to New Zealand.
The only thing I can possibly buy for myself now is something I could wear on my wrist. I have no space whatsoever.
We've got all everything we need in... I've got everything I need in two small bags on the back of my bike.
Yeah, right. That's it, huh?
That's it.
Travelling light, travelling
dirty. You don't have front
panniers. Travelling light, travelling dirty. We normally travel with front panniers because we usually have a tent and cooking gear and the works. But we heard that in Southeast Asia, accommodation is pretty easy to get hold of.
Sure.
And finding places to camp is quite challenging.
Sure.
So we opted to go lightweight on this one.
Okay.
And so far, we've always found somewhere to stay.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's been pretty basic, like a truck stop on the shores of the Yangtze River before we got to Lijiang, wasn't it? The day before Lijiang. They are constructing an enormous new road quarried into the rock face, and what a mess it is. But we think it's being made because the Yangtze level is going to go up as they produce another dam. But lots of people have been shifted, you know. They've lost their homes in China because of the damming of the Yangtze. But anyway, this particular night, we got to a small cafe, and we tried in our terrible Chinese accent, Jodian.
Ah, right.
And
Jodian.
They don't usually understand it, but we've got little cards which a friend of Pauline's from her previous employment gave us.
Ah.
And on one side it says hotel, on the other side it says Chinese symbols.
Yes.
And we point these at people and we say, the equivalent, have you got a room for two? How much is it? And so on. And this place, was it 50 yuan for the night? I think it was.
I think it was 45, but it was a bare room with white walls, two beds, but comfortable. She got extra blankets.
Yeah,
45 is not bad. That's like $7.
And they were so friendly, and they cooked us noodles, and we had noodles for breakfast as well, by the Yangtze.
Mm. Wow, nice. Sounds awesome.
It was good. I mean, our balance of payments in the long run is quite low, but sometimes we treat ourselves as we are here, so we spoil ourselves. But tomorrow night, I suspect we're back down to the 100 yuan level for our accommodation for the two of us tomorrow night. And then, you know.
That seems to be about average for like a low end, just basic hotel room, 100 quiet nights.
Yeah.
That's like 15
bucks. I mean, here we've got a gorgeous room in an old house.
Yeah.
It's just oozing character.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful and it's quite expensive, but we're enjoying it.
I'd say we've been on the bikes for 32 days now since Chengdu, and all the accommodation we've stayed in, bar one, has had Wi-Fi, a kettle in the room.
Yes, that's important.
A couple of mugs to make yourselves tea with your kettle. The plumbing has worked. The majority of places, the plug is a rotating disc, which works. Well, many countries of the world, and I'll name Mexico to start with, they've never got plugs. So we actually travel with half a squash ball. And this is fantastic.
If you get a squash ball?
A squash ball. A squash is a sport.
Squash.
If you cut a squash ball in half.
Oh, a ball.
A ball.
Oh, I thought, I understood bowl.
American accent, English accent, don't worry. Yeah. North of England accent, but not Geordie accent. Like, what we do call a ball, like, Cassie.
A ball.
St. James's Park, they kick the ball across the pitch and hopefully they get it in the back of the net. Do you understand what I'm saying, like, man? Dan.
I didn't sound a very good approximation of Geordie, but it's funny.
maybe I'm talking Jamie accent from Durham.
That almost sounds Scottish.
Anyway, where was I? The plumbing works.
Yeah.
What I would say is most of the toilet seats wobble. For some reason, they haven't attached them quite properly. Yeah. Why not? That is stupid. But hot water, yes. Cold water, yes. Drinking water, maybe not. But with a kettle, we boil the water and tend to pour that into our bidons. Bidon is the French word for drinking bottle on a bicycle. Mm. And we ride away with sterile water.
Wow, I mean the hot water thing is super important if you're Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
They will not drink cold water. It's just not a thing. And
cold water will make you sick.
Yes, cold water makes you sick. It's bad for your stomach.
Yeah.
Bad for your digestion. Hot water's good for you.
Is that to do with bugs in the water or
traditional Chinese medicine? And it's the yin yang of everything.
Okay.
But I've said to my students, okay, well, look at me. I have been drinking cold water all my life, and I'm never sick. Mm-hmm. And what about the rest of the world? The whole of the rest of the world drinks cold water and they're never sick. So what is it about Chinese people? Mm-hmm. And then they would just sit there and like... Because they never thought about that before. You know, they just accept the fact that if you do this, you will be sick.
Yes.
And sometimes it does happen because people expect to be sick.
Yes.
Yeah, but if the hot water they're drinking has been boiled... It does guard against them getting sick from infected cold water.
No, they don't mean infection, not that kind of sick.
Means
like a stomach cramp.
Talking of traditional Chinese medicine, we searched out Dr. Ho in Baiyesha, a 95-year-old man who apparently has the greatest knowledge of traditional Chinese medicine.
Wow.
And we found his...
You found him
on a street in Baisha, which is 15 kilometers north of Lijiang, on the way to the Tiger Leaping Gorge.
We went there. We didn't
find
him.
And this guy came out looking very old, with a long, straggly beard and things wrapped around his head. And he was so beautiful. The first thing he said to us, it was about the 5th of January, he said, "Happy New Year." And then he opened his guest book and asked us to sign in it. And he showed us newspaper cuttings on the wall, two of which stood out to us. One was Michael Palin, who was a Monty Python comedian, but is now really a travel writer and TV documentary man. And the other was Bruce Chatwin, who is more famous for his book in Patagonia, Travels in Patagonia.
Yeah.
But I think he wrote a book called What Am I Doing Here?
He wrote a few interesting travel books. There's one called Iron Horse. Which is about him on the Trans-Siberian, but a long time ago.
Yes.
When it wasn't an easy thing to do.
Mm.
He's a very good travel writer, yeah? I like his style. Mm. Mm.
So both of those guys had stayed with this
95-year-old? They'd been to see him. Yeah. Yeah, Dr. Ho, H-O. Which is quite funny, because afterwards I realized it's very much like Doctor Who. That reminds me, occasionally we were travelling in New Zealand and we saw a load of guys dressed in Lederhosen.
Oh.
Do you know what this is?
Yes, yeah.
It's just,
were they German?
Yeah,
they were. Around October, late September in Wisconsin, it's quite popular.
Is it?
Yeah, there's a large German heritage
right.
in Wisconsin.
Oh, that's Oktoberfest time,
yeah. Oktoberfest.
Yeah.
And they really do it up. Mm. But when we think of Germany, we tend to think of Bavaria. And only Bavaria. We don't tend to think of like Berlin.
And do you think of liters of beer at the same time?
Yes, yes, most definitely.
Right.
There's a lot of beer.
And do you think of Angela Merkel, one of the few remaining sensible politicians in Europe?
Yeah, I agree.
We might think that way. Yeah.
Along with Nicola.
And Nicola.
With Nicola Sturgeon. Yeah, yes. she's very sensible.
Yes.
Scottish First Minister.
Oh, okay.
But I quite agree with you. They're two of the very few sensible, honest, real people in politics in the world.
I could see a situation where, if we leave Europe. Switch the conversation a little bit here,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It's political, it's economic, it is worldly. If Scotland gains independence from the United Kingdom and remains in Europe, I think we may well move 100 miles north across the border.
You're not the only one, I would think that
myself. And I'd be motivated to live in Scotland, because Scotland is one of the most beautiful places in the world. There's just one problem. The climate is CRAP a lot of the time, but when it's good, it is fantastic.
And in winter, it's dark. I mean, one of our sons lives north of Glasgow in quite a nice little spot.
Yeah, I lived in Galloway for a lot of years, and dleich is a great Scottish word. Do you know this word?
No.
Yeah. There are some good Scottish words. Dleich. It means grey and drizzly and damp and wet and windy all the time.
So it's another word for Scotland.
Kind of, yeah.
It's a bit like the opposite to what it is right now here.
Yes, it's the
which is incredibly bone dry. You can almost feel the dryness of the atmosphere in your dry skin and dry lips. Blue skies. There's not a cloud in the sky.
Actually, there are some really good Scottish words. Like, I like peely-wally.
Never heard of it.
Have you not?
No.
Oh, yeah. You can feel a bit peely-wally, or you can look a bit peely-wally. It means kind of pale, bland, and insipid. Something can be peely-wally.
Wow.
I have this friend who...
you mean like Chinese beer?
Yes, that's a very good example.
You mean cat's piss?
I have a friend who works in a very posh wine place in London, and they all do posh things with wine tasting. And he was determined to introduce the word peely-wally into the whole wine tasting vocabulary, because it just fits. You know, sometimes you drink something and it's like, got no taste, it's bland. Peely-wally, great one.
That's
there's
curious.
A horse going by
that.
Us with bells on it.
And
these guys, basically, you rent a horse, but you just sit on it, and a guy walks you around the village.
Oh, right. I was wondering where they went.
And it's like a little tour. And I've never seen a foreigner on one. But,
no, I've seen a few Chinese on
pretty popular with the Chinese tourists.
Sometimes you can take them up the mountains, too. If you go up to, there's a trail to Ma Pingguan, which is a village in the mountains. I don't know which exactly direction it is, but it used to be an old... like a tax stop on the old ancient tea trading route. Like there were Chinese officials that stayed up there.
All right.
And if you want to go up there, you can take a horse and like some ponies, and they'll like throw all your bags on them and lead you up the mountain. It's really cool. And the village itself is really beautiful. It's kind of nestled up there.
Now this village is on the Tea Horse Trail, right?
Right, exactly.
So this used to be an ancient trade route that connected China with India, I believe.
With Tibet.
It brought
there's a lot
tea
of information
from Tibet.
Inside this temple building.
Oh, in the temple. I haven't gone in there.
I haven't been in there.
It's very interesting to read it.
This has been sponsored by a New York outfit called the World Monuments Fund. And there's approximately 100... buildings, ancient buildings in the world that are being protected by them, because they are seen to be threatened with extinction. Mm. So if you go inside here, it's 20 yuan for a ticket. I recommend it. There's an awful lot of information in English.
It's a very nice.
And it says quite a bit about what happened during the Cultural Revolution in the 20th century, when so many ancient artifacts were destroyed.
Right.
And they talk about it being an unstable political system.
Yeah.
I mean, that information, I'm not sure who's producing it, but it's kind of slightly critical, isn't it, of past Chinese government and accepting responsibility. Basically.
Which you don't find a whole lot around here.
No. I'd be surprised if that's not written from the World Monuments Fund, which curiously is based in the Empire State Building.
Is that right?
It is.
The World Monuments Fund?
Yeah.
I haven't heard of this.
We hadn't till yesterday.
Huh.
Yeah. But they only care for about 100 monuments, did you see?
Yes.
I wonder how they select them.
I'm not sure they only care for 100 monuments. There's 100 on their endangered list.
Oh, I see.
So they may care for more. I don't know enough about it to say. But
yeah. So, Liam, what brings you to China?
Well, I just graduated high school last spring.
In
Minnesota.
Yeah, in what subject? Or is that
no,
all
high
subjects?
School. High school.
Well, actually, the last 2 years of high school, I went to community college. And so I actually did graduate with an associate's degree in liberal arts.
Uh-huh.
But, in America, you don't graduate high school with subjects. You graduate high school and you
broad
get a diploma.
Spectrum.
Yep.
Yeah. Just like A-levels, you know.
Yes, in Britain we don't leave school and call it graduation. We call it graduation when you go to university for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and then you graduate. That's what the word is. I left high school.
But we
don't graduate from school.
Oh, we call it graduation when you're done with kindergarten. There's all sorts of graduations in the U.S.
If you told me that you left high school, I would think that you dropped out.
Yes.
That you stopped going when you were 14.
Okay.
And you lived on the street for a while.
And then you went to Beijing.
No, actually, I started in Taiwan. I've kind of been doing the whole circuit. But, I'm just taking some time to travel on my own. I used to live in China, so it's sort of a home to me. And came back here. It's my first time doing it on my own, and I'm just going around seeing friends.
So your parents were in China?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So
for a time.
Do you all speak Chinese?
We all speak Chinese.
And when I say do you speak Chinese, should I really say do you speak Mandarin?
Yes, we all speak Mandarin. Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
I've learned though since coming here, like when I took some audio lessons of Chinese, they told me the way to say Chinese, the language Chinese, was Putonghua.
There are many ways to say it.
But then I came here and everyone says Zhongwen.
Yeah, Zhongwen, Putonghua. Putonghua means, Putong means regular or normal. Hua is speak, so like the normal speak. But if you go to Taiwan, they call it Guoyu, which just means world language. And people will say that in other parts of China as well, but I think Putonghua is more common on the mainland. Putonghua, Guoyu.
But Zhong is like, that means China, right? And then
right. Well, Zhong means middle.
Means middle, but
right.
Here
and Zhonghua is China, which means the Middle Kingdom.
Yeah. So it's like RP. You see pronunciation, just regular. If you take the equivalent in English, it's just regular English without any accent and dialect. Is that what you mean?
I guess that's what they mean. Like, but people in Beijing, they say Zhonghua. They always say it. They don't say Putonghua because they're. I think Putonghua means like the common language,
right.
And Zhongwan, they just think of it as Chinese,
right?
As the common language. I it's hard for me to articulate.
Well, it's really interesting because it really depends on the perspective of the place. So
yeah,
like
in
Beijing, Beijing is the capital of China, and they have this sort of, you know, the common Mandarin is very. If I were to say it's closest to any sort of dialect, common Mandarin is closest to Beijing. How Beijing people speak.
Yeah.
Because Beijing people, they don't have a dialect separate from regular Mandarin, really, but they definitely have an accent. You can tell someone's from Beijing by the way they speak. I definitely have a Beijing accent when I speak Chinese.
Does it come out a little bit toxic with the air pollution? You know, through the breath?
There's a cough between each word.
Okay.
Then you know they're from Beijing.
Yeah.
No, but if you go to other like provinces in the south, their dialects, their local dialects, are just totally different from Mandarin.
Mm.
So then they really call it Putonghua. They have to, you know, they have to differentiate it. And I think it's really interesting because when you, like I said, when you go to Taiwan and they call it Guoyu, that means like the nation language, the world language, which I think is really interesting because if you go to Taiwan and you ask the Taiwanese people
You know, it really depends on who you ask, but the people in Taiwan, it's really a separate, well, yeah, it's a really contentious issue, but it's a separate, it's essentially a separate nation.
De facto,
do you like Taiwan?
I love Taiwan.
Is it heavily overpopulated?
It depends on where you go. So I spent most of my time on the east coast, on the southeast coast. It was very in the mountains, very beautiful, not a whole lot of people. I lived in a small town, the small town of Dulan, and it was just amazing. That place, I think, is just a little gem that nobody knows about.
Do you know
there's
been some full-page advertisements in the Economist newspaper, which is a world... It's out of London and New York and other cities, but it's a world paper. And from time to time, there's a full-page advert promoting cycling in Taiwan for a holiday.
Oh,
and we
cool.
looked at this and thought, hey, maybe we should do that.
It's amazing.
But then we look at the population density of the whole island and we think, hang on, this looks a little bit dense.
A lot of people do bike tours of the whole island. When I was there, actually, there were many like bike races that were going on. There were, one day I was trying to, my friend and I were trying to hitchhike up from Dulan to, we were going to Taipei, and we were like, okay, you know, it's like a 7-hour drive. We don't really want to pay for a train ticket. Let's just try to hitchhike up the coast. And so we woke up early one morning and got out on the road, and there was a bicycle race going on. So we were just on the shoulder of the road trying to catch a car while, like, every 2 seconds a bike would go in front of us. So it just was not working. Eventually, we actually did catch a ride, but we got, like, halfway, and then we were like, screw this. We'll just grab a train. But it was funny. But yeah, I think it's interesting because the whole northern section and then the whole western coast of Taiwan is very heavily populated. But if you get into the south and the southeast, it's much less so. And it's much less so developed. And it's really gorgeous. And the people are so nice. And
tell me, Liam, do the people of Taiwan think of themselves as Taiwanese, not Chinese, or Taiwanese... But Chinese.
Well, there are many different kinds of people in Taiwan. So there are the Taiwanese people, which are the natives of Taiwan, who have lived in Taiwan, who have been raised in Taiwan for generations and generations. And then there are the Chinese who have come over to Taiwan as mostly in the early 40s. Before the Cultural Revolution, there was mass immigration to Taiwan from the south of China. And I think in many parts of China.
Well, fleeing from the political situation. Mostly,
right, exactly. Exactly. So there are many groups, but I guess, yeah, I mean, people there definitely consider themselves Taiwanese. They have a very, I think most people in Taiwan have a pretty strong national identity separate from China.
The government certainly does.
The government certainly does, yeah.
Do the people of Taiwan now think that they like Donald Trump?
Oh, God.
Because of his phone call to the president of
Taiwan.
You
know, I don't know. I was in Beijing
It was the other way around, wasn't it? He accepted the phone call.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what he said, yeah.
Well, yes.
That's his side of it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. People in China tend to like Donald Trump.
Is Taiwan where you lived as a child with your parents?
No, actually, I had never been to Taiwan before this September.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my one new place. Yeah, I definitely recommend it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, you're selling me on it. Do you know how many people live there or what the population is?
Total?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know. I looked it up at one point, but I totally forget.
I can look it up later.
I can look it up now.
I think it's tens of millions.
It's quite a lot.
I guess comparison
that,
is, do you make that a comparison with China? Is it a Chinese number, or do you make a comparison?
Taipei is super dense.
Is it tens of millions, or is it hundreds of millions? That's what I'm wondering.
I didn't like Taipei at all, the city. No. Well, I mean, there's cool parts of it, but I just felt it was very... I don't know. I guess I'm not a fan of really big cities in general. It's just like shops everywhere and sort of stuff.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, not much character.
We'd agree with that.
But there are some cool like parks, and the Taipei Zoo is pretty cool, and it's super cheap. Everything is super cheap in Taiwan.
Is that right?
Oh, super affordable.
Cheaper than China?
I would almost say cheaper than China, depending on where you are. They have their own
just
currency.
Would not have thought
maybe that's cheaper
than
Beijing.
They have their own currency. It's the new Taiwan dollar. It's about 32 to 1 US dollar.
Wow.
Huh. Yep. And, yeah.
So, example, got their own, how much is a cup of coffee?
Oh.
Oh, man. I never got coffee, but I would go and get,
or a beer?
A lunch for, like, 15 Taiwan dollars, and it was, like, rice and braised pork, or maybe, like, a whole dish of noodles. I could get breakfast for 50 cents, like, a nice breakfast for 50
cents. Are there any
cents.
Direct flights from Dali to Taiwan this afternoon?
I doubt it.
I just didn't think of Taiwan as, I didn't predict it would be that cheap. You know, like Hong Kong is another kind of.
No, I would have thought the opposite. But it definitely really,
it depends on where you are, too. Because when I went to Taipei, things were definitely more expensive than they were in Doulan. In the small town of Doulan, everything was super cheap.
Yeah.
At least, like, the local stuff. You know, if you go to, like, a bar and you get, like, a fancy drink, of course, it's going to be a little more expensive if you're buying Western food. But if you're just, like, eating at the kind of local family hole-in-the-wall shops and you're just hanging out, you know, getting a beer every now and then, and it's... very affordable living.
We're knocking on the door of talking on world economy here because we get things cheap in Europe, massively cheap, because of things being made in places like Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And we're actually riding bicycles here, which were designed in the United Kingdom, a Newcastle company, I think, Genesis, but they're built in Taiwan.
Okay.
And the value for money is awesome. I mean, Pauline's bike was 1,000 because it's a 2017 model. Mine
pounds.
Was 800 pounds because it's the wrong color because it's a 2016 model. But they are identical. And the equipment on there is really high spec. Now, to me, to have a machine which doesn't use any fuel except the food you eat and the beer you drink and the coffee you drink, it's awesome.
Yeah.
But if that was made entirely in Britain, I wouldn't be surprised if it cost you double that.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that Donald Trump's political and economic message is to close down this international trading and make things in the USA. We're going to stop making cars in Mexico and importing them. We're going to try and make everything in our own home country.
Right.
Well, what will the American population think of this? Because their goods are going to become more expensive. Will they be able to afford their iPhones?
Right. And that message sounds so strange to me because it goes totally contrary to the Republican mantra of limited government.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like you just need to let business run by itself.
And he's a businessman and he has business interests all over the world. Yes. So that doesn't make very much...
Well, it's a bit peculiar. I was going to say
that doesn't make very much sense, but do you really expect somebody like that to make sense? I don't
know. No. I mean, he's just saying what people want to hear. And it's not going to happen. Whatever jobs are gone, they're gone. Unless the rest of the world is rapidly catching up to the developed world. I mean,
but you know where the money is? I mean, the manufacturer goes where it's cheapest. It's going to Africa.
It's going away from China.
Definitely.
I mean, labor is getting more expensive in China.
Yeah, and Chinese involvement in Africa is absolutely fascinating. I am really, really interested.
Anything about that? That's interesting.
I think there is a problem with this getting your goods on the basis of cheap labor in other countries in that you don't know what kind of working conditions those people have. You know, they've got people working all hours in a polluted factory and living on pennies, and you're getting your cheap goods at their expense sometimes. And one of the great things about the European Union that we're planning to leave, not us personally, but Theresa maybe, then is that it equalised all that, and the trade was done on a kind of equal level of similar working conditions. And
but the other side of that is, if you look at, you know, there are a lot of factories now in China, and people do work in conditions that may not be terrible, but they may not be of European standard. But it's that work that has actually brought those people out of poverty. Whatever else you say about this government and this country in the last 40 years, they have taken more than 50 million people out of poverty.
I'd even multiply that by 10.
Yes, probably. Much more.
500 million.
Yes. Probably.
But and 500 million are also living with toxic air now.
Yes.
There's downsides to it, for sure.
But those people are looking at the future, and they're not... They know that this is wrong, but they also trust that the government's going to sort it out.
They do.
And nobody wants to go back to what they were.
They're happier now.
Oh, absolutely.
Anything's better than starving to death.
Yes.
I mean,
you're right. And I mean, I've just spent the last 3 years with 18, 19-year-old students, and every one of them will tell me that either their parents, or most definitely their grandparents, were very often starving.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you, my parents were very, very poor. when my family were growing up, they didn't have enough food to eat. They only maybe had rice. Yeah. Every one of them.
So you can have generation. That, or you can put a mask on when you walk outside. Which will you take?
The mask?
You know? Yeah. Give me the mask.
Because the mask, it's a step towards the future, and they trust the government to sort it out.
Yeah.
And it has been getting better. The smog has actually been, in the past few years, it's sort of hit a peak, and it's been improving.
I think about
And there's a lot of policy in place that's moving that forward.
Yeah, I think 4 years ago, or maybe it was five, was the airpocalypse, I think they called it, in Beijing. And that was the worst year.
It was the worst.
And every year it's gotten, I've seen the numbers, it's maybe like 10 to 15% better every year.
And China is now the leading manufacturer in the world of renewable energy.
Yeah.
They've decided to shut down all of their coal-fired power plants within the next, 5 or 10 years or something.
And when they decide to do something like that, it just happens.
It happens.
They don't go and ask public opinion or anything like that.
Oh, they don't
discussions
need
about
very
it.
Quickly.
It's just like, we'll do it.
There were four giant coal-fired power plants around Beijing. Mm-hmm. All of them are shut down now, as far as I know.
Right.
But the city, unfortunately, is in a location that traps pollution because it's surrounded on three sides by mountains. And outside of Beijing, you've got a lot of smaller cities that are these manufacturing towns.
Yeah, and smaller.
Yes.
Smaller but
cities of 3 or 4
when
million.
If you come back and look in, say, 10 years, and I'm pretty sure that the pollution levels here will be massively reduced.
Yes.
Simply because the government did it and told everybody. And then you look at somewhere like Delhi, in the world's largest democracy, where stuff really doesn't happen.
Yeah.
It's a lovely place. India's a brilliant place.
Yes.
But stuff doesn't happen, and it's probably going to be even worse there.
Probably will be. Mm-hmm. And it's a different type of pollution there, though. That's kind of the problem. You know, it's more like the burning of trash, right? And burning of crops. Isn't that right? In Delhi? Or is it more industrial?
I'm not sure. I think it's pretty much everything. And cars as well.
Cars are a big problem.
Yeah, cars are a real big problem.
Diesel engines in London are a big problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For us, cars are a big problem, actually. I mean, our ideal is a world where there's kind of hardly any cars and it's beautifully quiet ways to pedal around, but it's not like that.
Well, I think we're moving toward, not toward no cars, but we're moving toward electric cars. We've made giant progress on that front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now that Tesla has opened up its market in China, too, I mean, like we talked about in our podcast a little earlier, you go to Beijing and you see a lot of electric cars now. You see, cars in general, but you see a lot of electric cars.
Well, most of the buses
the
are hybrid.
You have electric motorbikes, you have electric scooters.
Yeah, the buses are mostly hybrid.
The buses, they are.
Right, and they have the, I don't know what you call it, the electric wires running a
trolley or tram.
Not on tracks, but buses
like
that run on electricity.
Like picking up the electricity.
They don't make any noise.
Yeah.
They're good. Yeah, and those run through Beijing.
The drive towards cleaner fuel, isn't a lot of it coming from hydropower? And massive dams on beautiful rivers like the Yangtze, and that's also got a downside.
That's true.
When you look at the... Yeah, when you go down into the Tiger Leaping Gorge and see the amazing power of that three river flowing through the gorge, and there was a plan to dam that, and it was abandoned, I think, in 2007. And it's sad to see the world's rivers being classified like that and turned into giant lakes and people being displaced. And so
I'll tell you an interesting story about that. I've just been living in Nanyang in Hunan, and it's right in the middle of China. It's kind of half a day south of Xi'an, in that kind of area. And it's a big agricultural place, very poor, but they've got a lot of water. And over the last few years, they've been building this canal to take water from the area to Beijing. Mm-hmm. So there's this really big canal. It's pretty wide, you know, the size of a river, and it's fast flowing all the time. All of this water is going, and as part of this whole program, they built a reservoir, they dammed this whole area. Lots of people were displaced from their villages and stuff like that. The whole economy, agricultural economy in the area, has changed because the water, the available water in the area, isn't as it was before. And if you ask people, we are very proud to help everybody in Beijing. It's our duty. It's our honour to help. It's our duty to be
that's
the police.
Interesting.
I asked a load of questions. We went on this tour one day with the university, and we saw these models, the villages that had been flooded and everything, and I asked, you know, the usual kind of questions. Did they want to go? Where have they gone to now? Where are they living? And the answers were not very clear. Just everybody said they were very honoured to do this. It was their duty.
Isn't this what do you think this is what they think, or is it what they're told to think?
Well, there isn't any thinking involved, really, is there?
Exactly. Or do they not want to say what they really think?
Yeah.
Well, they don't have any choice.
I'm thinking of where I went to North Korea last year. And, like, you know, you can't get people's like real opinion there. And so I wonder, was it like that, where they pull someone aside and like this is a pre-selected person to talk?
We were in a big place. There was a big model. It was at this reservoir. They had built this huge scale model of what the place looked like and the villages then and then now. And the person that was taking us around, or the person that was reading the stuff, actually it was our own guide, and she was reading the stuff, and it just said everybody was very honoured and happy to give up their poor lives for a better life now and to help people in Beijing. So there was just no answer to any of the questions that we asked.
Well, I did meet one American guy who's lived in China for a long time, and he kind of thought like that sort of attitude is why China's going to take over the world.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they will do something, they will sacrifice now for like their great grandkids who won't even be born for 50 years. Mm. And that's not the kind of attitude we have in the West.
Mm-mm. What does the phrase China's going to take over the world mean?
I don't know.
It's the Chinese dream.
Yeah.
It's a pinky in the brain situation, as far as I'm concerned.
Does it mean economically? What does it mean? I don't know.
Well, from what I've understood, and I've talked to a lot of people, this is just what I've understood, is that Chinese values are what they want the rest of the world to respect and have. And I think it's a very, very interesting way to build an empire, the way the Chinese are doing it, because it's not war or marching in or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it's all about money.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about what they've done in Africa, they've built an infrastructure in Africa. It's not loans. They've just done it. We'll build you loads of roads. We'll help you to do this. We build you cities. It's not a loan. They just do it. Mm. But the payback is that Chinese people can go and live there. But the number one payback is that the Chinese government has rights to minerals.
Yes.
And natural resources. They've got first refusal. China is corner in the world in the precious metals that are needed for technology.
Yes. It's a very stealthy way, isn't it?
Absolutely. So what's happening is that they're building up. They're really popular. China is very popular in Africa.
I'd like to throw something fundamental into this debate, though, and that is, in a modern society, a caring society, I think the government fundamentally should be providing free, at the point of use, healthcare for all its citizens.
Mm. Yeah?
I think that is fundamental in a good society. And if you look at Cuba, it does that. Mm-hmm. And it exports doctors to places of crisis. For example, when there was the Ebola outbreak, Cuba did it. Fidel Castro said we must have free education for everybody, we must have free healthcare for everybody, and it has done it, it's succeeded, and it has it to this day. The UK has free, at the point of use, healthcare, but it is severely threatened, and we are very worried about our right-wing government actually hinting at privatising healthcare, which would be a catastrophe.
More than hinting, actually, if you delve into what they actually do.
I believe that China is not very good at healthcare for its citizens.
And it's an interesting thing, because I've had some private conversation classes with some of my students, because they're all university students, and we can actually have these kind of conversations. And in one of my little conversation groups, they would Marxism came up, and I said, and I sort of laughed, and I said, well, this is not a Marxist country. And my students all looked at me in astonishment and said, yes, it is. So how can this be a Marxist country? Like, this is one of the most capitalist countries I've been
in. Absolutely, yes.
And they were like, no, that's not true. So I said to them, okay, well, look, you guys go away and think about this, and next week we'll have a discussion about what Marxism really means. And,
yes, good one.
And let's talk about it, because for me, it means socialism means just what you said. Free healthcare, free at the point of need, free education, caring for young people, caring for older people. Mm-hmm. You know,
equality, more equality, less difference between super rich and poor.
That's hard not to make that happen. Mm. But the other things allow the opportunity, I guess, to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they came back next week, the following week, and they'd all had a big discussion about this, and they all felt really that they needed to defend a lot about this government to me. And I listened to what they said, and it didn't really make a lot of sense, because I realised that they had never had any discussion about Marxism. They'd been taught this. Mm-hmm. And I questioned what they were saying, and it still wasn't changing anything in my head, because I'm saying, well, I can't see it. Where is it? And then one of the students said, it's our policy. We are striving towards Marxism. I said, wait a minute, how can you strive towards Marxism in a capitalist society? What's the government going to do? One day just go like that and say, right, stop this capitalist bit. We're now going to have a Marxist economy.
They could.
Well, they could. Yes, but
not
by that
they would.
By that time, China will have so many connections with the rest of the world.
It'd be almost impossible.
Do it.
Yeah.
And then this was the best thing. One of the students said to me, but you don't understand, because actually we have just changed the definition of Marxism. It means something different here. And I said, all right, okay, that's it. Yeah.
Marxism with Chinese characteristics.
That's the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to Cuba and it's so obviously a communist country. I mean, we saw one advertisement in Cuba, and that was the Corona beer on a van. Apart from that, nothing is advertised. And I find that very refreshing, actually.
And when was that? Were you there?
We were there 2 years ago.
All right. I bet it's changed even now.
Not quite 2 years ago, actually.
It's changing quickly, from what I hear.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
the but what you do have is revolutionary slogans everywhere.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Everybody's working hard for the revolution on great posters across the road.
And the Marxism thing has, obviously there are benefits to it, as we've just discussed.
Yeah, there's definitely benefits
But then Cuba is also a very poor country.
It is also a two-tier society in a sense, in that people have been allowed to open up their homes as like bed and breakfast. They call them casa particular.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And you can stay in these homes. And for them, the money you give them is a huge amount, although for us it's not. It's a very cheap place to stay. But for them, it's a huge amount in the dollar-related peso, the convertible peso, rather than the...
Right, because there's two currencies there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you need this dollar-related peso to buy luxuries like shampoo. We were forever being asked by women, you know, do we have any shampoo to give them?
The local women asked?
The local women.
Oh, interesting.
Cuba may be poor, but would it have been poor but for the embargoes?
Well,
these embargoes
exactly.
Have been going on for decades.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can't tell.
No.
Yeah, we don't have a when scientists
control.
Do an experiment,
a control.
We don't have a control.
I think one thing is for certain, it's society is better off in quality of life and life expectancy than its neighbours such as Haiti and Jamaica.
Definitely.
Yeah, okay. I would agree with that.
The life expectancy is pretty good. And everybody has enough to eat. They may not have exciting food, but they have...
Okay,
they have a ration. We were actually shown a kind of little ration card, which allows them to things like rice and oil and bread and a few vegetables and things. And everybody has that ration of food, which they get for peanuts. You know.
Yeah.
But then if you want something different and more luxurious, it will cost you a lot.
But you're quite right. That's an interesting point, you know, that it's possible that a communist country could have evolved into something more economically diverse if it hadn't been for the embargoes.
Mm-hmm. I said the way they responded to American aggression, you have to admire it, actually. This tiny island, you know, they fought off the Americans at the Bay of Pigs, and they didn't bow to the pressure. They said, right, we're going to get on, we're going to grow our own food. But, you know, they had gardens in the cities growing food for the population. And
it is amazing that that little country was able to survive all these years, and Castro himself survived dozens of assassination attempts.
Unbelievable. Exploding cigars.
Did you read the news? I was reading some interesting articles the other day about Myanmar. What's happening in...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Only about 100 miles from here, you know.
I know. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, the world's famous, world's most popular housebound prisoner is turning out to be quite a despot.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
What's her name again?
Aung San Suu Kyi. Or something like that.
Dissident? Right? Is that... Did she write a book or something? Why is she in house arrest?
No, she isn't now, but she was for about 20 years, and she got a Nobel Prize for Peace Prize, and she was like, you know, the number one hero of the oppressed, and this poor woman who was bound to her house and wanted all these great things for her country, which has a military dictatorship, has had for a long time. And then a couple of years ago, things changed. She isn't at the head of the government, but she's a very, very influential part of the government.
What did she do initially?
Nothing. She just wanted to, what she said was peace in the country. She opposed the military dictatorship.
Well, that's something.
That's quite a something.
Yeah, but now she's in power and her government are doing even worse things.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. I mean, I just read a couple of articles over the last 2 or 3 days. More and more information is coming out about these terrible atrocities that are going on in this. There's a lot of small ethnic groups in different parts of Myanmar, and they're being really oppressed, and lots of people are being jailed without trial for dissent or for criticizing the government.
And she's responsible for it.
Well, she's not responsible. She's in the government.
Okay. She's not stopping it, you mean?
Mm-mm. Huh. No.
That's interesting.
There was always a lot of criticism about this woman. If you really... She was held up as being the, you know, an icon of peaceful dissent during her years in house arrest. But if you searched around, you could see other analyses of this woman. And really... She had no policies. She wanted to be in government, but she had no policies. She had no thoughts about what the economy was really going to be, or, you know, if she was in government, what she would actually do. And, you know, it's a country with... it's very, very poor. They've got no economy, nothing happening.
And yet it's another place which... Britain will have some responsibility for its history.
True. Yeah. Well, interfering
imperialists.
I'm sure you found the same. I've found that there are very few places on this planet that haven't got some kind of grudge to bear against the English at some point in their history.
Well, the Europeans. In general, maybe the Spanish also. I mean,
I was going to say the English or the Spanish or the French or the Americans.
The wiped out like, whole world. Ethnic groups in South America.
Oh, it was horrific, yeah.
Yeah.
And I can't say I'm that proud of our British imperial past, to be honest.
No, definitely not.
Tell us about travel in North Korea.
North Korea?
How did you get in there for a start?
Well, there are. You can take a tour. You're not allowed to go by yourself.
Okay.
It's completely closed for that purpose, but you're allowed to go on a tour. And almost all of the tours start from Beijing. and I happen to be living in Beijing, so it's just, you know, perfect for me.
Yeah.
Most, like a lot of people will fly out to Beijing and then go on the tour from there, and their whole vacation is North Korea.
There's a train from Beijing.
There's also a train. I was not allowed to go on the train because I'm an American, and that's really the only restriction against Americans, is they're not allowed to go on this train. It's just kind of a random thing. So I flew to Pyongyang, and you always have two guides, or minders, they might be called, and they're, at least two anyway, and their job is to basically make sure you don't screw up and do anything offensive.
Did you carry your kit?
Oh, all the audio equipment? No, but I did have a camera, and I probably could have brought, like, audio recording equipment. Wouldn't have been an issue. They've loosened a lot of restrictions lately. You're allowed to bring an SLR camera. You're not allowed to bring a telephoto lens, but they never actually checked. They checked my camera when I got in.
What if you got one of these that kind of zooms out?
That will be fine.
Almost too.
As long as it doesn't say GPS on it.
Yeah.
And if it does, you put a piece of tape over it. Because it used to be you couldn't bring cell phones in until a year or two ago. Now you can.
What if it's got the letters ICBM on it?
then they might encourage it.
What's ICBM?
Intercontinental Ballistic Missile.
Yeah. But now you're allowed to bring your smartphone in, and every smartphone has GPS in it. Mm-hmm. So they're just paranoid about those letters, really.
Yeah.
I personally didn't bring a phone in because I was just paranoid. Probably too much. Let's wait for this horse to go by.
Hello.
These things are so loud. You're allowed to bring a laptop in now? And it's all subject to search, of course, but they didn't search anybody's stuff when we left. Mm. When I came in, they just had me turn on my camera and push the play button to see what was on it, and I didn't have any photos on it because I'd just gotten there. Right. They said, yep, good to go. Right. And that was it.
Yeah.
It's actually not a hard country to visit at all.
Did you have two personal minders, or was it for a group?
For our group. Now, you're also allowed to go there on your own, as long as you take two minders with you. If you can pay more money, and the tour company will set it up. And there are large areas of the country that you're allowed to visit, and then some areas that you're not allowed to visit as a foreigner. So, for example, there's a ski hill there now. And I met these guys who were going there to go snowboarding. And I don't think it's, like, an awesome ski hill or anything, but it's just kind of the novelty of it.
I went snowboarding in North Korea once.
Yeah, just to say that. There weren't any tours going there, so these guys hired their own minders to follow them.
Pull up.
And we're getting some more coffee here. And you...
Actually, I don't think we ordered for you two.
No, I'm okay.
I didn't mind. I'm fine.
I'm okay. You're not allowed to just wander around on your own there, except when you're in the hotel. Not a good bike tour place.
Cycling minder.
I did see a video. I saw a video of some guys who rode from Russia all the way through North Korea, and I want to say they went to South Korea. I think they went through the DMZ.
That would be wild.
And of course, they had the minders, and it was all set up, and they had their own kind of, like, non-political reasons for doing it, and they got secured all the permissions. So it has happened.
I've looked a little bit at South Korea, and it's quite attractive for cycling.
Yeah, South Korea, I think, would be a beautiful country to cycle through. Absolutely. It's super safe, really developed.
Yeah,
There's probably a great road infrastructure.
Look at the people as well.
Great people. There's a really good outdoor community too, and of retired people who go hiking. And it's kind of funny.
Everybody walks with ski sticks.
Yeah, they all walk with the sticks.
Oh, just like France.
Oh, just like in France. Yeah.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. Oh, someone's
made a hilarious video just taking the mick out of these poles. It's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. And they all have the brand new Lycra and all the clothing and bright colors, and it's cool though. It's cool to see these communities of, you know, older people, like, getting together and going hiking. Mm. It's like something we don't have much of in the States. It's really...
It's something you do in France. You see a lot of people like our age and older out walking with their poles, but looking very fit, very slim.
Uh-huh.
And in Britain too, in the Lake District.
it's populous. But it's walking popular is, I think, walking and fishing are the two most popular outdoor activities in Britain.
I see so, yes, yeah.
In China, too, you see a lot of people hiking up mountains is a very, very popular activity, and older people, too, because they say it keeps you healthy. If you hike mountains, it'll keep you very
healthy. Oh, there's like the five sacred mountains.
There are the five sacred mountains, and, yeah. Well, it's easy in China, and there's mountains everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And most of these have staircases going up them.
Yep, yeah,
it's just a different way of looking at it. But Beijing, too, has a small but very dedicated cycling community. Like, these guys will, like, they'll bike out to the Great Wall and back in a day and, you know, ride up 120 Ks or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. It's cool to see. And they have very nice, expensive bicycles. Now, that's not a high percentage of Beijingers. A lot of people there have the really crappy bikes. That,
okay, like this one behind us.
Like,
have you seen this guy around and about? He looks like he's about to set off a gas alarm for mustard gas in the First World War. He's got an old-fashioned helmet and a mask on.
Really?
And a small rucksack that looks like it's First World War outfit from the Somme. He'll come back sometime.
Oh, wow.
Take a look at him.
Oh. I'll ask him how life is in the trenches.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. He's got looks like a one-speed bike, and with those nice little brake grips on the sides.
Yeah.
And broken bell.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just parked right behind the
rack. It's interesting to me that here in China, when people lock up their bikes, they don't usually lock them to anything. They just put a lock around the back wheel.
Just like the Dutch
call
do.
It good. Mm. The Dutch do that too?
Oh, yeah, I just do that too, yeah. I never think about locking it to something.
In England, you mean? Or in China?
I don't know, actually. I live in places where I don't lock anything.
But contradictorily, in Beijing, there's a pretty well-known problem of bike theft.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people I know have gotten their bikes stolen.
Here he is. Look.
Oh, there he goes. Anyhow, he's got a military uniform on.
Yeah. Good morning.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Just practicing. You speak English, ma?
Oh, to be George.
Speaks a little bit of English. Huh.
What's he on about?
Can you ask him what he's doing?
What's his game?
Go on, let's practice your Chinese.
Are you getting this, Dan?
I can understand a few words. They live.
It doesn't sound like he's speaking in any way that... He's got
a police jacket on, is that something?
Yeah.
Well, I used to boom in by. I understood, like, live here and a couple other words, but I don't understand the vast majority of what he's saying.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
Yeah, it's... Chairman Mao.
Oh, yeah.
Chairman Mao.
Mao
Zedong. Fly. Beiji. Fly. Yes.
Have you noticed how many spokes he's got in his rear wheel? That is phenomenal.
That's true, yeah. It's like double the normal amount.
I bet that's and his tire's in good nick, you know?
Yeah. Hey, I mean, it gets you where you need to go.
Yeah.
And not very fast, but...
Yes.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.